Welcome to the Real Clear Politics Takeaway for Friday, January 15th. I'm Andrew Walworth. This week, the House impeached President Trump for a second time, with 10 Republicans joining all House Democrats to vote in the affirmative. Action now moves to the upper house as the lawmakers debate just how quickly to start a Senate trial. Meanwhile, President-elect Biden called for a $1.9 trillion COVID relief plan, which would provide a second round of direct payments to American households of $1,400 per person, as well as a $400 a week supplement to unemployment insurance that will last at least until September. All this is happening while Washington, D.C. and state capitals around the country brace for what may be another week of violent protests. As one longtime Washingtonian I know who works near the White House told me yesterday, they asked what it would take to keep me from going to my office every day. I told them martial law, and we may pretty much be there. Joining me to talk about all this are some of my colleagues at Real Clear Politics. Tom Bevin is co-founder and president, Carl Cannon, Washington bureau chief, and Phil Wegman is White House correspondent. So, Tom, impeachment moved through the Democratic-controlled House very quickly, but now it goes to the Senate, which is scheduled to reconvene on Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, we have the inauguration itself. What's at stake here, and how do you think this is going to play out?
Well, I mean, we'll see what Democrats decide to do in the Senate. You know, I think there's a constitutional question of whether, you know, they can even take this up, because it's a different Senate than the House that impeached them. May have to go back and do it again if they really are intent. But nobody thinks that they're going to get the 16 or 17 Republicans that they need to actually remove Trump from office. And by the way, he won't even be in office. So what's the point? I think Democrats are worried, some Democrats anyway, are worried that it's going to be a distraction. It'll bog down Joe Biden's first 100 days and his agenda. And they have a lot of things they want to do, and they want to do quickly. But they also have a lot of rank-and-file members and others, and this is why you saw it go through the House the way it did. You know, they wanted for posterity, for the historical record. They wanted to impeach him for it. I mean, and Carl and I have talked about this before. They could have gone for a censure, and they probably would have gotten a lot more Republicans on board. Probably would have been the smarter political thing to do, because it would have ended it. It would have been more, perhaps, appropriate. But we are where we are, and I don't know exactly what the Senate's going to do. Some folks are saying they're going to take it up, and they'll do it kind of quickly. But even if they try and do it quickly, it's going to be a distraction for at least a few days right when Joe Biden takes office.
Carl, is Mitch McConnell the key figure here? How's he viewing this, you think?
He's one of them, Andy. Chuck Schumer is too. You know, the Senate's going to be 50-50. The last time we had that, it was a power-sharing arrangement. It's hard to figure out how Democrats and Republicans share power today, since they don't even talk to each other. People are watching McConnell to see what he does. And, you know, to Tom's point, and we did talk about this on Thursday's podcast, these are actually separate questions about should the House have taken up impeachment, and then should he be convicted in the Senate. As you listen to the Democrats, it seemed that they were really making a great case for a censure. And if you listen to the Republicans, you see, a lot of them would have gone for a censure of the president. And if you'd had, you know, 400 votes against denouncing Trump for what he did, I think you would have sent a stronger message in a way, because it would have been a bipartisan message. Having said that, that's not what they did. Pelosi pushed impeachment. The article's waiting in the Senate. If you have a Senate trial, the longer it goes, it seems to me, you're going to have evidence. If they collect evidence, if they call witnesses, I mean, one of the things you'd ask in a Senate trial that was done in a regular order, to use a capital phrase, i.e. while the president was actually in office, what was the president doing? You know, he sent these people to Capitol Hill. We know that. Why? Because he said, we're marching to Capitol Hill. We're going to go. They thought, the crowd was surprised. There was a New Yorker story out today. They were delighted. Oh, he's going with us. That's great. The crowd started marching towards that Capitol before the president ended his speech. What did he do while this was going on? Did he cheer on these rioters? Did he stop it? The point I'm trying to make is that you could build a case. The case may be stronger for conviction than it was for impeachment. Impeachment's a political decision they made. But once it's a trial, you know, then you're deciding based on the facts. And the longer it goes, to me, the more you could build the case that, yeah, they have to go through it and they have to convict the president, something that's never happened in our history.
Phil, one part of the calculation that Mitch McConnell must be making is whether, in addition to conviction in the Senate, they would vote to preclude Trump from running for office again. How are Republicans looking at this from the point of view of the party's future?
I think the way Republicans are looking at this right now is they see that, yes, impeachment would necessarily keep Trump from running for office again in 2024. Finally, he would be done. But Republicans are also thinking to themselves, this isn't just about the president's political future. It's about theirs as well, and trying to figure out whether or not Republicans are going to be perpetually tied to his legacy. And I think the concern from some Republicans is twofold. First, you have some Republicans in the House, you know, during this impeachment fight, who were rebelling against Republican leadership, specifically Liz Cheney, the chair of the Republican Conference, who backed impeachment, and they were rebelling against her because they thought that her opposition to Trump was an attempt to turn the page on you know, the populist conservatism that he had put forward. That's one part of it. Another part of it is I think that Republicans are opposed to this impeachment, not just not because they don't think that what Trump did was wrong, but because they see this impeachment push as an attempt to lump them in with his actions at the Capitol. And they are afraid that if they don't put up a fight against impeachment, that essentially they will be ceding ground to Democrats who want to say, we should have known from the very beginning Trump was always racist, Trump was always going to incite violence, and if you ever supported him, shame on you. So I think that's sort of what some Republicans are thinking through right now. And look, to Carl and Tom's point, a lot more Republicans would have been happy to censure him, call it a day, and put this behind them.
So, Tom, is Trump spent, do you think, as a force, regardless of what happens?
I don't know. You know, the conventional wisdom is, yeah, he's done, he's toast. You know, you read all these stories that he's got no shot. There was a story in the Cincinnati Inquirer the other day that I tweeted out. So this guy called together 40 Trump supporters. They met at a local movie theater, and he invited six people who were in the march in D.C. to explain and talk about why they were there and what they saw while they were there. And then he took a poll and asked them, these 40 supporters, how's your support for Trump? Now, like, do you support him more or the same or less? And not a single person, not one out of the 40, said they supported him less. There were a couple that said they supported him the same, but 77% said that their support for Trump was more or increasing. So I think we might have a situation where, once again, the conventional wisdom that's ricocheting around the Beltway might be at odds with what actual voters are thinking. There was an interesting kicker to this article, which I also quoted, which was, and this is the host of the focus group. He said, "What you heard tonight, there was no, quote, we're going to rush the Capitol," Hicks said. They thought they were at another Trump rally. And this is to Phil's point, which is of the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who were there, a lot of them did not partake in the violence, did not even know that it happened. It doesn't excuse it, obviously, but this is the flip side of the quote-unquote mostly peaceful protest that we heard over the summer. And I think to the extent that the Democrats try and paint the Trump movement as everyone, all 74 million people who voted for him, are complicit in insurrection and an attempted coup and all this language, I think they risk overplaying their hands and giving Trump a potential opportunity for a comeback.
I guess, Carl, the argument is that Trump might be able to win a Republican primary again, but he couldn't win another national election, and that would be the fear that Republican politicians would have at this point. And to Tom's point, you can still win a Republican nomination with about 40% of the primary vote, depending on what the field looks like. So is that the nightmare scenario if you're Mitch McConnell?
Yeah, I think it's one reason McConnell's publicly sort of toying with the idea of going along with impeachment. They want to make this guy go away. They don't know how to do it. Phil was talking about, you know, if you impeach him, you have to add the language to the impeachment that he can never run for office again. I covered it seems a long time ago now, it's probably 30 years. Alcee Hastings was a federal judge. He was impeached in this he was impeached and convicted in the Senate from Florida. They didn't add that he could never run for federal office. I think they just forgot to do it. The guy's going to prison. They didn't think that they had to do it. Well, he got out of prison. He ran for Congress. I think he's still there. Phil would know. I think he's still in the House. I think he probably voted for impeachment the other day. Anyway, so they've got to remember to do that. They can't forget why they're doing this. But even then, what if Trump, Tom's point is this is a movement. And what if he runs his son as his proxy? They're not done with Trumpism until they can come up with a candidate. And I'm talking about the establishment Republican side. But if you take a step back, what we're looking at is post-Cold War, the Republicans had trouble finding another Reagan. And why? Well, because guys like Reagan and Roosevelt come along, once every half century or so. But Reagan stitched together the Republican Party when I was Phil's age and just got to Washington was comprised of two very different groups. One was what we associate with the Southern, the Baptists, the cultural conservatives, Pat Robertson, and people who talked about homosexuality, school prayer, sex issues, right to life issues. And the other were the more laissez-faire, libertarian, economic conservatives, Barry Goldwater, Paul Laxalt. I think of them as Westerners. Now, of course, there's evangelicals in California and there's laissez-faire Republicans in the South. But, and Ronald Reagan was their champion. But Reagan was able to knit both of those great wings of the party together. And I think one of the answers to this is a person, and that person may not be on our radar yet, but what the Republican Party seems to me to need, and the results in Georgia showed this, where they lost both Senate seats, there are more Democrats right now than Republicans in this country. We're a 50-50 nation, but it's not exactly even. You've got the independents. They're about a third. And what you need is a leader who runs on the Republican banner, who can get both the populist Trump, the people that Trump brought into the party, who didn't vote for Mitt Romney when he ran for president the first time, let alone what they think of him now, and the establishment Republicans. You need both groups, and you probably need more Latinos than they've been getting. Reagan and George W. Bush showed that. You probably need a segment of the African-American community. You certainly can't just write off Asians. And so the future of the Republican Party is going to look different than it looks now. I'll make this prediction. No major party will ever nominate two white males again to run. I think Pence and Trump will be the last ticket like that. And if they do, they won't win. So you're going to look at a more diverse party, not just racially in terms of gender, but in terms of ideas. And they're going to need someone who gets all of those people to vote together. And still they may not win because that's where we are.
Phil, Carl mentions Mike Pence. Tell me about the White House this week. I mean, Mike Pence seems to have been, he seems to be the president these days.
Yeah, effectively. Last night when Joe Biden was giving his speech about a economic rescue plan, you had Mike Pence on Capitol Hill for a surprise visit to the National Guardsmen from around the country who were there to protect the inauguration. It was a very presidential photo shoot, if you will. And for the most part, you've seen Pence step in. It's odd because for the first time in probably the last 4 or 5 years, it's been oddly quiet because Donald Trump is off of Twitter. He was kicked off. He doesn't have that venue anymore. It has been surprising that it has limited him, because he's not able to communicate in the way that he once did. But I think on top of that, the president also knows that he can't get out of the mess of last week. He has stayed quiet. Mike Pence has been perhaps not his best friend, but his best advocate. We saw him try and reason with Nancy Pelosi and say that impeachment would not be a worthwhile option. Pence essentially said there was pressure on me to do something unconstitutional, which was throw away the Electoral College vote. I didn't do it. Now, Pelosi, you're doing something unconstitutional. That argument didn't succeed. But I think what this essentially shows is Pence very much is the vocal leader out of the White House right now. And at a moment when a lot of Republicans are rethinking their association with Trump, at least for the last 60 days, there's been a lot of praise for Pence and even bipartisan praise for him. I think that he's been enjoying a bit of a bump in the last couple of weeks.
So Phil reminds us that the president, that Donald Trump, is off of Twitter, and I guess my question is if that caused him such stress, as he has an aneurysm, will Jack Dorsey be an accessory to manslaughter? I mean, what's the poor guy gonna? How's Trump gonna get out these impulses?
Well, it was funny. The obviously the White House has this huge communications apparatus, but it was funny that it was sort of reduced just to sending short little pithy messages from the president. The other day, the White House sent out a note about how Trump had done more for the U.S. military and more for troops in Afghanistan and Iraq than any other president. Normally, that would have been a tweet, but these days it turned into a short 100-word press release.
Well, let's just switch then for a moment to Biden, who will be taking over on Wednesday.
Oh, the president-elect. Good idea. Let's talk about him. The new president.
Yeah. Phil, you had a piece today, which I commend to people on the Real Clear Politics site, about his announcement of a new COVID relief plan. It's $1.9 trillion. What do you make of the plan, and how is it different than what Trump would have proposed?
I think the difference here, the main one, is that so essentially there are three buckets. The first is money for combating the virus. The second is direct payments to families, and then rental assistance and nutrition programs. And then the third bucket is payments to small businesses, and then also cities and states. It is a detailed plan. All of a sudden, the Biden transition got very wonky on us in that they released a 17-page press release detailing how they intended to spend $1.9 trillion. And even then, that detailed plan was still kind of vague. So this was a starting point. But I think that the takeaway from this is that Biden is serious about spending considerable money. He is serious about, not letting states figure out how to distribute the vaccine. Instead, he wants the federal government to have a significant role in getting 100 million doses of the vaccine administered in his first 100 days. And it was interesting because while Biden did not mention the current political fight, which is impeachment, he seemed to reference the political fights that consumed a lot of the Obama-Biden administration when he sort of headed off Republicans of the past and straight up said, yes, this is going to include deficit spending, but we have to do it because it would be too expensive not to.
So, Tom, are Republicans going to rediscover their conviction that deficits and debt are terrible things? They didn't complain much when Trump upped the national debt by, almost $8 trillion. What about now?
So Republicans have already, I think Marco Rubio had said, listen, just do the $1,400 payments to individuals and families as a standalone bill. Let's get that out the door and deal with the other stuff later. I think Republicans would be in favor of that. They're going to oppose the what they consider bailouts to states and cities, places like my own city of Chicago, which, has been mismanaged for decades and now is looking for, COVID relief, some of which was caused by COVID and some of which wasn't. So this will be the first test of the Democrats' new majority, right? And what they're going to do with the legislative filibuster. Because if they do away with the filibuster, then they can just jam this through with 51 votes. Kamala Harris comes in, hits the gavel, and it becomes, goes to Joe Biden's desk, he signs it, it becomes law. That assumes for the time being that folks like Joe Manchin would sign on to it and go along with that. I'm not sure that's the case. So it's going to be an interesting, if Republicans do stand up and push back on the $1.9 trillion, obviously they're going to take some heat. They're going to be called hypocrites, because of how they signed off on the spending under Trump. But it will present the Democrats with a sort of an immediate test for which way they're going to go, how they're going to govern. And so I think in that sense, it'll be interesting.
Phil, what do you think?
Really quickly, I think we're all going to become a lot more familiar with budget reconciliation in the coming months. basically that provision which allows you to pass significant portions of legislation by a simple majority rather than by 60 votes, so long as you include legislation that is germane to spending. From what I understand, the Biden folks are still hoping that they can get this passed normally with 60 votes, and they are sort of holding out the possibility of having their Senate allies use budget reconciliation, that parliamentary tactic that lowers the threshold to 50 votes, for their second round of relief or more reforms in the future. So that would
delay the fight over the legislative filibuster.
Yeah, yeah, for now. But I mean, and that's just, you know, another another fly in the ointment when Biden is trying to have his 100-day honeymoon, and others are pushing for impeachment and questions about the filibuster and other things mucking it up.
Carl?
Well, when I saw that half of the $1.9 trillion would go to West Virginia, I thought, okay, this thing passed.
The Joe Manchin vote.
Highway, renaming it.
Joe Manchin.
Democrats, yeah. In the current environment, they might be willing to rename all that Robert Byrd stuff to Joe Manchin.
Yeah. So, but in all seriousness, when I hear Biden talk, he's focused on what I would have liked Donald Trump to have been focused on for the past 2 months. He talks about the pandemic. We've got this virus. It's been developed. We have two companies, Moderna and Pfizer, who are churning it out, and factories that I assume are running, you know, three shifts, 24 hours a day. I would hope that's true. They're getting to the states. Some of the states are doing better job than others. West Virginia, the state I just mentioned, has of this this week vaccinated a higher percentage of its people than Virginia, where I live, had vaccinated the people, its first responders, the people in its first tranche of lists. So, you know, the governor, this is not everything's being treated equal here. Biden has said he wants to just get the shots in people's arms, you know, and he's talking about you need a booster shot. So some of the health officials say, well, we got to make sure we save every shot for every person. Biden is saying, let's just go ahead and get the shots in the arm, and then he'll, you know, jawbone the companies to make more of it. And if that approach works, he's going to be very popular in this country. You're going to have things, you know, the Arlington health official put out a statement the other day. Well, it'll be it'll be June or July before people get their shots in Arlington. Well, that's absurd. And Biden is saying, no, that's not how we're going to do it. The Trump officials have finally 2 days ago or 3 days ago said, yeah, Biden's right. You know, after not letting the Biden people into the White House coronavirus task force, till last week or the week before. So if Biden does this, you're going to have things that you haven't had. You're going to have March Madness. You're going to have spring training. You're going to have a Kentucky Derby. A lot of these
people. Oh, your wish list.
Well, yeah, but
it's always interesting to know what Carl's real.
Jeez.
Carl will get a haircut.
Hey, Carl, let me ask you though.
Wait, one quick set. Let me just finish one thought, Tom. What I meant is things will return to normal. And a lot of this pressure, I mean, from the Proud Boys to Black Lives Matter, we know that a lot of these people, Americans were angry, they were fed up, they were scared. A lot of that will dissipate. And to me, when we're talking about Biden's initial start, how he does on coronavirus will set a tone for a lot of this other stuff.
I just wonder about the 100 million in 100 days. I get why it's a catchy phrase.
Yeah. Yeah.
What happens if he only gets 50 million? I mean, he's opening himself up to this idea that the last thing you want to do coming into office is make a huge promise and underdeliver. And he's making a huge promise with a timetable on it, 100 days. We're going to be able to tell exactly where he is. And if it doesn't go well and he gets to 50 million, it's going to be a political failure for him.
Well, Tom, I hear what you're saying, but let me use a different metric. I don't think that will be the test. We're losing.
Why not? That's exactly what said.
Well, wait. I'll tell you why.
Don't judge me by what I say.
Right.
No. Let me make my point. You guys can crap all over it after I make it. Okay? Here's the point.
We're losing, to preemptively crap on it, Carl.
We're losing 4,000 American lives a day. That's the number that I think is the key number. If that's 400 instead of 4,000 after Biden's first 100 days, if he's got 50 million or 70 million or 100 million shots in the arm, we need, flatten the curve. Hell, we need to empty the hospitals. We need to make this disease go away. We need to really lower the death rate dramatically and significantly. And if that happens on Biden's watch, the exact number of vaccines will be less important. That's my view.
Does anyone actually think he can do 100 million in 100 days?
When I was speaking with Biden aides the other day, they were very quick to point out that they felt like they were starting from square one, that they were working with the current administration, and that they were disappointed in the infrastructure that they found. But what I was struck by yesterday, you know, not only did he say he's going to get 100 million vaccines in 100 days, and that's a very real metric. He also said he wants to get the majority of school children from kindergarten through eighth grade back into school. I think a lot of parents are going to be excited about that. I'm not a parent, but
it's more important to Tom than the Kentucky Derby.
But there was a tone shift. And look, let's not kid ourselves. I think that, you know, Biden has a lot more allies in the press than Trump ever did. I think there are going to be some who are willing to make excuses for him. But in his remarks yesterday, Biden sort of made it clear that this was an aspirational statement. And, you know, while it's a hard metric, it's an aspirational statement, but he also said, I'm going to be honest with you about the failures and the setbacks that we have. And I think that if he stays true to that, if you have during his first 100 days, someone going for broke, trying to do everything they can. But then, you know, if we get to March the end of his first 100 days and Biden comes out and says, you know, look, we got 60 million doses of the vaccine out. You know, we could have done better, but, you know, we did the best that we could. Here are the challenges we ran into. I think, you know, that sort of admitting that mistakes will happen and that change in tone in comparison to the current president, I think some people will give him leeway, you know, if he falls short of his target.
I will. I mean, if you're doing 500,000 vaccines a day, and we're going to do that, let's do this show in the 100 days, and Tom wants to say, oh, this clown, he's only at 79 million. All right, I'm going to push back on that.
In all seriousness, I think both Phil's point and Carl's point are worth are well taken, in that if people are not dying, if the curve has been flattened and there isn't this sense of urgency, it's going to matter less the actual number of vaccines, whether it's 50 or 70 or 100. And I think that's a good point. And Phil, I think, is also right that I think the press is going to take a completely different approach. If Trump had promised 100 million, you know, vaccines in 100 days, you can only imagine. First, they would have shouted him down saying that's impossible, it never happened. And second of all, if he got to 99.9 million, you know, they would probably be
fact checks. Pinocchio's, four right, Pinocchio's.
Four Pinocchio's, right. So we're in a different era.
Well, we just have a little bit of time left, but I do want to talk about next week, the inaugural activities. You know, I was in Washington, D.C. yesterday. It does look a bit like martial law. I think that's a fair approximation. There's 20,000 troops on the street, something I've never seen before. I also live close to Annapolis, Maryland, the state capital of Maryland, and they're putting barricades around our state capital. Carl, I'm just wondering, when you look at this, what are you expecting for next week, and what's it going to look like?
Well, they're closing the bridges in Washington. They want to empty the city. So, Phil, I live in Arlington. I probably won't be able to cover this inauguration. So, right here in front of our audience, I'm asking you if you can be down there. You live in the city, Andy. It's going to be an inauguration like nothing we've ever seen. I would have thought this is a great overreaction. Two things on the part of law enforcement, two things have changed my mind. The first is that New Yorker article I referenced, it's about a very good reporting, a guy who traveled with the insurgents for weeks leading up to it. And it sounds like this was not quite the spontaneous riot that I thought it was. But the other thing is, we're still in the throes of this pandemic, what we're talking about. You talk about a super spreader event. If we had 500,000 people on the mall, I mean, that's just a death sentence for some percentage of them. So I guess I'm okay with this, but it doesn't feel right, does it, to have an inauguration where people can't go, to close off the capital city to people? I mean, something out of the Hunger Games. And so I hope this is the last one like this that we ever have.
Tom, what do you think?
Well, I just watched a video from 2017 of Inauguration Day that's been pinging around Twitter, showing that, you know, there was burning, cars were burnt, windows were broken, cops clashed with, you know, Antifa folks, rioters, whatever you want to call them. It was not all peaceful and you know, unicorns and roses on January 20th, 2017, but there was no curfew. There was no military presence there. There was none of that. And so, you know, look, we are where we are, and what's happening is what's happening. I think it's unfortunate. I agree with Carl. I hope it doesn't happen again. I hope everybody behaves themselves, and we can just move on and get to a more rational place in this country where temperatures are lowered and mobs are not tolerated in any way, shape, or form, whether they're coming from the left or the right. Behave yourselves, obey the law, and we go back to, you know, peaceful protest. You know, put on your pussy hats, and we can do all that stuff. But the violence that has occurred over the summer and up to last week has to stop. And it just, and hopefully we will get there immediately.
I spent the last Inauguration Day. I spent a couple hours in the emergency room because of some of those demonstrations. I thought that they were just sort of normal rabble rousing. And instead, when I was downtown in Washington, I got hit over the head by a member of Antifa, got concussed, wrote about it, and then realized later that evening that I should probably go see the doctor. But yeah, I think that, like, if you look at these two inaugurations and you look at what happened in between, yes, there was violence last Inauguration Day. It was not as serious as what happened when the Capitol was breached. But I was speaking to Ken Cuccinelli, who is deputy director at Department of Homeland Security. And I think that a lot of people dismiss as whataboutism anyone on the right who wants to talk about some of these riots and bad behavior. But I think it's wrong. It's not whataboutism. Instead, it's sort of a lowering of the threshold every single time. Because when you have someone storm a Target in Minneapolis, that's one thing. And then it's a police precinct, and then it's a federal courthouse. And certainly, you know, what we saw at the Capitol was the most serious. But I think that we got to a point in Cuccinelli and other conservatives' minds that people on the right saw what was happening with all of this bad behavior, and they saw that there weren't a lot of consequences. And so bad people on the right learn from bad people on the left's bad behavior. And this is more than just sort of rabble rousing. You know, this is a question of, is that fundamental thing, when we can't agree about anything else, we should be able to agree on the left and the right that political violence is wrong. And frankly, you know, there were a lot of people for the last 4 years who did not rebuke it the way that they should have. The troop presence in Washington, D.C. is a natural reaction to that disorder.
Carl, last word.
Well, Tom and I wrote a column about this week, and we quoted Lincoln. Lincoln's always sound. And he said that the answer to combat the rise in the mobocratic spirit, Lincoln said this when he was 28 years old, was for the public to rededicate itself, quote, to the reverence for the laws, end quote. Fidelity to the law, Lincoln insisted, quote, must become the political religion of the nation.
Well, as you say, Carl, Lincoln is always sound, so that's a good place to end today's discussion. This has been the Real Clear Politics Takeaway for Friday, January 15th, 2021. I want to thank my guests, Tom Bevan, Carl Cannon, and Phil Wegman. You can find out more by visiting realclearpolitics.com. You'll find articles, polls, podcasts, and videos, all from a wide variety of different points of view. And thank you for listening. Until next time, for Real Clear Politics, I'm Andrew Walworth.